Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday, the 23rd of August, 2023, and this is Reconstruction, the Construction Index podcast with David Taylor and Phil Bishop. We'll be talking about some of the recent happenings in the world of construction, as per usual, and one or two other things besides. But first, good morning, Phil. How are you?
I'm doing very well, David. How are you doing?
I'm very well as well. Yes, can't complain. The weather's perked up a little bit, so that always makes a difference.
you wait till the bank holiday coming up this weekend.
Oh, that's true. Yes, it'll piss down. Okay, never mind. So, both you and I mean, I said that we'd be talking about construction. Obviously, we will, and one or two other things besides. And one of the other things is some of the obstacles that we face in our job. You know, of course, we don't actually work in construction. I think a lot of people forget that. We actually work in publishing and the media, and it just so happens that UK construction is our bread and butter. So we're dealing with construction people all the time. We know them, they know us. But our businesses are slightly different, and we have slightly different ways of approaching things. And both of us have had rather frustrating experiences in recent days, haven't we?
What we're talking about here, folks, is that construction companies are in the business very much of risk management. And they get very, very nervous at the idea of anyone saying something about them which they haven't vetted and crossed the T's and dotted the I's and so on. And in years gone by, we would forever get into trouble if we ever published a photograph in a magazine of someone who's PPE was not on at the right angle or in the right way, and you can't show that. And said, "Well, it's just a photo of a construction site this week that was happening." Yeah. You know, it's not a lie; it's just the truth. And said, "Yes, but we can't publish the truth. We've got to varnish it and gloss it."
Yeah.
Yes, and so sometimes people talk to us, give us a great story, have a big long conversation, and they'll say, "But if you're going to write anything, we have to see it first. We have to approve what you're going to say. You know, you are not a free agent. There's not a free press. You're not independent." And this can get tiresome. And anyway, I went to visit I was kindly invited to visit. I'm wondering whether to name names or not, but I think we have to, because otherwise the story doesn't...
It's got to be obvious. It's got to be
obvious. The story doesn't work. A fabulous company called Pacadar, Spanish company, who make tunnel lining segments for HS2. And they previously did all the Thames... I say all. I think a lot of, if not all, a lot of Thames Tideway... No, it's some sections of Thames Tideway, super sewer, tunnel lining segments for that. And they invited me to their facility on the Isle of Grain, Thamesport. And very impressive setup, very nice people, enjoyed the day, enjoyed what I saw and so on. And at the very end said, this being HS2, they have to control everything that's written, so you'll have to let HS2. And I thought, that's all a bit dull.
Yeah.
So when I got home, I rang up the HS2 press office and said, look, we've got a problem here. You know, I had a lovely day with these people. It's all very good and interesting. I'd like to write about it. But they're saying that you have to vet what I'm saying. And HS2, God bless them, said, no, we're fine. You go ahead. Not a problem with us. We preferred it if you'd arranged the visit to them through us, but it's happened now. So, write what you want. We don't need to see it. So I went back to my new Spanish friends and said, oh, good news. It's all clear with Pacadar, all clear with HS2. And they said, yes, but we've still got the two contracting joint ventures that we're supplying, EKFB and SKS on the, SCS on HS2. So they have to see it. And listeners might think this is a good thing that companies get to fact check and so on. But as you know, and you've got a similar experience this week.
Yes.
Companies don't just want to fact check. They want to insert adjectives and change the tone and sell and insert their own particular message when they start get the opportunity to stick a finger in a pie.
Yeah.
So I'll ask you about your experience there, but what, so at the moment it's, I am probably not allowed to write because no one's going to say, yes, that we approve this copy. But I am allowed. No one's stopping me, but I don't want to get Pachydar into trouble. I don't want to get Pachydar into trouble. And if I write something that, you know, makes Pachydar look bad in the eyes of their client, I've no desire to do that. They're, you know, a good company working hard, employing lots of people, and good luck to them. So I can't write this, but there was nothing said about what I could say. So I will break my exclusive news story for listeners of Reconstruction, because I don't know when or if you might be able to read about it on Construction Index in the magazine or on our website or news feeds. But listeners can hear that. One of the most interesting things, or the thing that struck me first when I arrived in Thamesport, this sort of Freeport odd area in the Isle of Grain, was there were tunnel lining segments lined up everywhere. There were, and I asked them, said how many, and they said they're generally supposed to have about 12,000 rings, which and seven segments per ring. So 1,200 rings in stock. Yeah. They make about 20 rings a day, 100 rings a week, times seven for segments, and they're meant to be shipped at that rate, going to the the tunneling contractors and going straight into the tunnel. However, the tunneling is behind, and they have now got a stockpile of 2,600 rings in stock. 18,000 segments. And these are huge, great, three, 4 ton, big blocks of concrete, just stacked up all over this place, this area, waiting to go. And I said, is this not costing you money? And he said, well, we have to hire extra land to rent the extra land to stockpile our surplus stock on. But we can't slow down production because we're contractually obliged to produce this. And It's a bit of an issue. And I said, but do your clients reimburse you for that? I said, oh yeah, they reimburse us. So that's an extra cost to HS2, a knock-on cost of delays, is that someone like Pachydar has got to stockpile these tunnel lining segments on someone else's land. Now they do say quite rightly, and they in no way are knocking the tunneling contractor. Pachydar have been making tunnel lining segments for decades, on a Spanish high-speed railway before moving to the UK for the Thames Super Sewer. And they say it's quite normal for tunnel boring machines to, you know, perhaps start off slowly and then build up speed, and then they might sort of slow down a bit with hit some, you know, bad rock or whatever. So these things don't move at a uniform speed. So there might be times when there's a bit of surplus stock lying around. But it looked like more than a bit of surplus stock to me. So I thought that was an interesting tale, which I'm happy to share with people.
Yeah, that is interesting. Yeah, well, that's an interesting... I've had a similar experience, funnily enough, with another Spanish firm, a contractor called FCC. You know, obviously, I didn't want our listeners to think that we're Iberia-phobic or whatever it is. We haven't got anything in for the Spanish at all, you know, but it's just coincidence. About a project I was writing about, through one of their suppliers on a project in Wales. It's a very interesting project, actually, technically very demanding, and they've been quite innovative in the way they've tackled it. So, yeah, very interesting job. They came to me through their supplier, or rather their supplier came to me and said, you know, we've got this interesting story. Do you want to write about it? And I said, yes. And they said, we'll give you all the information. And in fact, they did. They've got a lot of information actually on their website, which I could plunder at will. So that made my job easier. And of course, I didn't have to take extensive notes like I often do when I'm doing a feature and I have to interview somebody over the phone and take notes while I'm doing it. All the facts and figures came directly from them. I obviously had some, you know, I wanted to fill in some of the gaps and probe one or two aspects of it, which I thought might bear further investigation. And so I sent them emails, and they, both the contractor and their supplier, came back to me with lots of information, which was great. And so I put the piece together from that. And towards the end of this process, it was mentioned, oh, that we, you know, the classic thing, this is what makes any journalist's heart sink, is that, of course, yeah, you will send us a draft copy for our approval before you publish it, won't you? And the answer to that is usually, no, I won't do that, because that's not how it works. And sometimes, if you detect that the people involved are not accustomed to dealing with the press, you often, you know, it's a good idea to flag these things up beforehand, because otherwise, obviously, people don't realise that you're not writing it for them, you're writing it for your readers. And that's a subtle difference, but fundamental difference, which a lot of people don't really appreciate. And they will ask for this, or you can head it off at an early stage. But when you're dealing with people who are actually professional, I'm using air quotes, which our listeners can't see, professional marketing and PR people, they should know, you know, how this works, and you shouldn't have to spell it out for them. But on this occasion, they clearly didn't. So I thought, when I was asked to let them see the copy, I thought, well, how do I handle this? And I thought, well, actually, all the facts are theirs. And I said to them, you know, if you want to, they said they wanted to check the facts and figures. And I said, well, that's, you know, you supplied all the facts and figures. There shouldn't be any problems. But they were quite clear that they wanted to see it. So I said, OK, then you can check the facts, but you'd be basically marking your own homework. You know, there won't be any problems with me getting the facts wrong if the facts were right when you gave them to me. So anyway, I did, against my better judgment, I have to say, agree to let them check facts. And of course,
oh, that's controversial, Dave. I hope no journalists are listening. They'll look down on us. It's
well,
it's,
they will. I mean,
it's a shameful thing for a journalist to admit that, isn't it?
Well, I know, but the circumstances were such that I thought that this was probably the, I mean, it was a bit more complicated than that, but I thought this was probably the best way forward. Check the facts, but don't alter the copy. Anyway, so off it went, and it came back covered with deletions and insertions and modifications and rephrasings and all sorts of stuff, which anybody who writes copy for a living would find rather insulting, seeing as, you know, that your job is to write. And we pride ourselves on being able to write clearly and relatively skillfully. And when somebody comes along and inserts all sorts of clumsy additions and obfuscations, you don't really appreciate it. Anyway, so it all blew up. And the thing is that listeners might already know or might suspect that, you know, I don't just write stuff and send it off and publish it. It is checked. It's checked by you, actually. You read all my pages.
I confess I don't go as far as certain American publications profess to have, you know, fact-checking departments.
Yes.
And where
they
will ring up everyone quoted in someone else, you know, the fact-checking department will ring up everyone quoted in an article and say, did you do this? And is this how you spell your name? And any numbers, any, you know, dates or whatever, yep, they will actually run, everything will be absolutely verified. I confess, we don't have the resources to check everything. No. I assume your facts are broadly correct. However, if you get a number which clearly looks wrong or something doesn't look right, I'll flag that. In fact, I had a press release this morning came to me talking about, I think you had a number of 1,207 million construction workers. And I thought, no, there aren't even that many construction. That's 1.2 billion construction workers. There aren't that many in the world. And I thought, well, that's clearly wrong. So, you know, went back and checked, it should have been 1.2 million rather.
Yeah. But I mean, you cover the news, so you generally know what's going on. Yeah. And you can spot, if I've made a, you know, schoolboy error, you will often spot that and correct it on my copy. And if you spot something which actually doesn't ring true, you'll check it. I mean, back in the days when publications, even fairly modest business-to-business publications, employed full-time sub-editors, these things were checked routinely, and you had this sort of this filter of another pair of eyes, of an impartial pair of eyes, reading your copy and reading it with a critical eye to see if there's anything which seemed a bit off. And and sub-editors would correct your grammar and they would rephrase clumsy sentences and stuff like that. But that's what they were paid for, and they were in-house. Nowadays, I mean, even on the BBC or the Telegraph or the Mail Online, they don't have, because news is online these days. Most news is online.
It's instant.
You don't have, yeah, it's instant. You do not have sub-editors. So you will see on the BBC spelling mistakes, appalling grammar, stuff like that, that would never have got through in the old days. A Fleet Street newspaper. But anyway, that's a separate point. But we do have, what I'm trying to say is that we do have a method to our best ability to pick up errors and mistakes and inaccuracies and correct them. And that's what we do. But the thing is that our readers, they expect an impartial view of these things. They don't want to be reading somebody's puff. They don't want to be reading what they think is purports to be a news story and which they suspect is probably an advertisement. And there's the other point is that, you know, a lot of people would say, well, hang on a second, if you're writing about me, you're telling people things about me, I need to be in control of that. Well, the thing is, no, you don't need to be in control of that. Because if, say, the Sunday Times investigation team were to show all their copy to people they're investigating, guess what? It wouldn't be impartial. And we're not investigative journalists to that extent. But the thing is that if a third party controls the media, the copy, then it's basically an advertisement. They're in control, not us. And that completely undermines our business model, because who's going to pay for advertising space if they think, oh, we can just go and get editorial coverage for free? And so, you know, the whole thing, you know, tumbles down. So that's why we have to keep the editorial completely independent, and we have to maintain control of it. It's not to do with our egos. It's to do with our raison d'etre. This is what we do, and this is why we do it.
Of course, I endorse and agree with everything you're saying, but there's another way of looking at it. It's he who pays the piper calls the tune, basically, because you and I have both, in freelance capacities, undertaken corporate writing assignments for, you know, a company's magazine or whatever purpose. And if they're paying us to write, you know, 2,000 words on whatever it may be, then they are of course entitled to change what they want, do what they want with it, and say, you know, oh no, you've got to say in this article that our managing director is the best looking person in the world. fact, you know.
Yeah.
It's up to them. So, well, you know, I'll do whatever you want me to do. I'm working for you.
Yeah, exactly.
But if I am doing an article for a magazine or a newspaper and they are paying me, then the person who's being written about is not, you know, has no ownership. They can choose not to cooperate, not to help if they want, entirely up to them. But they can't stop me writing what I want to write, as long as it's fair, legal, etc., etc. Anyway, do you think we're whinging too much, David?
Yeah, I think we are. We're talking about ourselves.
I would like to say
other people's problems.
I would like to say in conclusion that I have absolutely no beef with Packardart. I thought they were fabulous, and I hope I'm able to get something written about them without having to go through all the vetting channels that they are hoping that I will go through. Hands up, and we say that we think we broadly get things right. We got our facts wrong between us in our last podcast, David.
Oh, did we?
When we were talking about CE marking and UKCA, UKCA marking,
yes,
and all of that business. Regular listener Rory O'Connor. Hello, Rory. He's from the Road Surface Treatment Association. It's not the first time, actually, he's tipped me the wink that I might have got hold of the wrong end of the stick on something. And he's saying, actually, it's not, you know, we gave the impression that moving away from CE marking was a Brexit, well, it's sort of a Brexit thing. Mm-hmm. But just because we're outside the UK is now not in the EU doesn't mean to say we're not part of the CE thing, because the, as Rory points out, the EN European Standards Committee has got 34 member national standards bodies, 27 EU countries and 7 non-European countries. So wow. UK, Iceland, Norway, Turkey, North Macedonia, Serbia, and of course Switzerland. I mean, you rightly pointed out that the capital of CE, or the offices, are all in Switzerland. So we should have twigged then. Hang on a minute, Switzerland's not in the EU, but we didn't manage to put those two things together. And Rory O'Connor himself is the chair or convener of the CEN Committee for Road Surface Treatments. And so he's, you know, he's, and it's what I was saying before, that there's a lot of British involvement in the whole CE marking universe and European standards universe. And clearly there still is.
Yes.
So we've still got British people drafting, reforming and whatever, European standards, but somehow the British government say, no, you know, we've got to have... Well,
it gets crazier, doesn't it?
As we talked about before, they've backtracked from that, and we'll see what happens to building products. But for other things, yeah, the CE mark will continue to be recognised. So we got that wrong. Sorry, folks, and thank you. Okay.
That's an interesting bit of clarification. You and I probably wouldn't have known that if we hadn't made that mistake and somebody had pointed it out to us. So, you know, you live and learn.
Well, we learn by our mistakes, of course.
Yeah. Let's go. Shall we move on to our next topic?
Yeah, the main event. This is really what we're talking about today, isn't it? David, you've been putting together... when does it go to press, the next issue of the magazine? September issue of the magazine?
Goes to press tomorrow. So okay. It should be out next... Yep, goes to press tomorrow. Yes, it's September, and it's our annual Top 100, which is a feature we run every year, where we get a freelance journalist who is an old construction news colleague of mine, Steve Mennery, who runs the rule over the 100 most... Well, the 100 biggest construction firms by turnover in the UK, and then does a very in-depth report on their financial performance. And it's interesting. I mean, some things don't change. For example, Balfour Beatty is still the biggest UK-based construction firm by turnover. So a lot of things are fairly predictable, but there's always something to learn. And one of the issues which he pointed out was that... insolvencies have increased massively over the past year compared to 2022. In fact, insolvencies are their highest level for 14 years, according to the insolvency service. Did I say 14 years? Yeah, insolvencies are the highest level for 14 years. This is according to the insolvency service. And there were 6,000...
What period is that covering? Because our top 100 rankings, it should be said, is only based on the latest available filings.
Yes, that's right.
End of July, I think, is it? Or the
The cut-off is 31st of July.
And then for anyone who's reported their results after that. So some of these people, I'm just looking at the article that's going in the magazine in front of me. Bam Nuttall, for example, which I think we ought to start thinking about consolidating with Bam. But that's... calendar 2021 results, whereas other people, ISG and Mace and Morgan Sindall and Balfour Beatty, it's calendar 2022. So
yes,
you're kind of sometimes comparing apples and pears, but as we've discussed at length before, there are all kinds of anomalies you just have to push to a side and say, we'll go with what we've got.
Yeah. There are numerous caveats, but it is, it basically... It's a valuable exercise, and it does give you a snapshot. As long as you bear in mind those caveats, that it's not everybody's financial year start and end on the same dates, and not everybody reports at the same time.
But your insolvency figures were for 2022, I'm guessing.
Yes, that's right.
Because I think it's going to be even worse this year.
The number of construction companies falling into insolvency has reached its highest level for 14 years. I'm sorry, I'm quoting now from Steve's copy. In the second quarter of 2023, the insolvency service recorded 6,342 insolvencies in England and Wales, which was 13% up on the same stage a year ago and the highest number since the second quarter of 2009. So that's construction firms we're talking about.
Well, we've talked before in the first quarter that we saw some quite big names, Tolent, probably the biggest, and Metnor in February went. But since then, in July, when was it? Henry Construction Projects in June, Ad Astra Access in June went into administration, Jay Tomlinson in July. And just in the past week, we've reported on Alma and Border Steelwork have both gone into administration. But the biggest, I mean, any other week, we'd be talking about this as our main subject, I suspect.
Yeah.
Buckingham Contracting Group is not in administration. But it has ceased trading and filed notice to appoint administrators. And they're looking for a rescue plan. And I dropped a quick note to Buckingham this morning to see if there's any update on that position last week, the statement they put out last week. And as of now, there's no more news, no more to report.
Right.
So they're still desperately trying to save all those jobs and get that something back up and running. But Buckingham Group Contracting, who are about number 50 on our list, are they?
Buckingham are number 30.
Number 30, beg your pardon.
Yeah, yeah.
So that, I mean, that's, yeah, they're number 30 this year. Yes. Where were they last year?
Number 95 by profit. They were a bit further down. I think they were 32 or 33 last year.
About the same. Okay, they're broadly top 30.
I just want to correct a mistake which might have crept in earlier. I said that all those 6,342 insolvencies in the second quarter of this year were all construction firms. That's not true. Only 18% of them, that's 1,122, were construction firms. So that's cleared up. I've just checked it. Sorry, where were we? You were Buckingham.
I was just saying that you're saying the first quarter was the worst for construction insolvencies since 2014 was the year? No, for 14 years, you said.
Yeah,
which,
14
years. Which takes us back to the big financial crash of, 08, 09 period and the backwash from that. And I think the indications are that the second quarter is quite likely to be even worse. I mean, we saw a lot of companies were propped up during COVID and then they enjoyed the COVID bounce back as the sort of suppressed demand coming out. And then we've had the that extraordinary budget last year, followed by interest rates spiraling and so on and so forth. And so what's really caught people cold is the materials and labour inflation, price and energy, and all prices going up across the board. And they've taken on work at fixed price and they can't deliver the work for the price that they've agreed to be paid.
Yeah.
And people are getting burnt. Some people are able to absorb it or manage it somehow.
In our top 100, we quote somebody from EY Parthenon, a chap called Ian Marston, who's a partner and head of construction at EY Parthenon, strategy and transaction business. And he points out that, this is his quote, "The big contractors went through a lot of pain post-Carillion," which, of course, we've reported on before. The banks came down hard and went for profitability. And he said, "The way I like to describe it is that companies are being run by their chief financial officers rather than their chief executives." So they're watching the pennies now. And as a consequence, the tier one contractors, generally speaking, and of course, Buckingham is an exception to this rule, generally speaking, looking okay, but it's the tier two, the people further down who are on fixed price contracts, who have really felt the pain as a result of this. So that's quite an interesting observation, I think.
Talking of feeling the pain, there was our top 100 is about contractors rather than house builders. But, Persimmon, top house builder, a couple of weeks ago now, half year results, sales down 30%, profits for tax down 66%. And it said that basically that they're going to squeeze subcontractors. They're looking to squeeze subcontractors, suppliers now. That, if we're having a tough time and you want to be on our team, you're going to have a tough time too.
Yeah.
What's the quote?
They're the people actually building, aren't they? We're talking about the people who actually do the building work.
Chief Executive Dean Finch came, "We are reviewing our subcontractor pricing on a more frequent basis to identify opportunities to secure increased savings. We're actively retendering sites. Just as we absorbed many price increases from subcontractors in recent years, so we need to share the cost pressures in this new challenging environment." So that, you're going to get you might expect to get paid more as your costs go up, but your house builder clients are expecting to pay you less, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
Crest Nicholson just this week in their a trading update, they're saying that Persimmon were talking about their 6 month sales to end of June, I guess. Yes. But as Crest Nicholson is saying, actually the last 3 months of summer, things have got even worse. They were expecting a sales per outlet per week of 0.5 this year. Past 7 weeks, it's been 0.25. In other words, they're selling their houses and apartments, houses at half the speed that they planned to, expected to.
Yeah.
And yeah. Things are just getting worse. And if that's the story at the moment, that we think that, you know, things are bad, but they're getting worse, it's pretty grim out there. So you're, oh, I've just been joined by a wasp. I might have to open a window.
Yeah, I just saw that. You sure it's not a hornet? It looked very big.
Yes. I was with friends at the weekend, and chap took a sip of his wine, sitting in the garden, sip of his wine, and a wasp flew out and bit him on the lip. It blew up like a...
Stung him on the lip, you mean?
Stung him on the lip, yes, and... His lip blew up so much that he was unable to finish his wine without spilling it all over himself. But he gave it a damn good try. Well, I've opened the window. We'll see whether he goes or not. So where was I? Okay, sorry for the waspy interruption.
Yes, okay.
Yeah, our top 100, the feature that you're coming out in the September issue of the magazine, is by and large, I mean, apart from you talk about, it's got some up-to-date numbers on insolvency and so on, but the rankings and the tables, it's by and large good news. I mean, it's the profits per company, or the aggregate profits, I think, higher. Well, let's have a look, actually.
Yeah, they are higher. I haven't got the figures in front of me.
I've got this year's and last year's. Aggregate turnover altogether has gone up from 66 billion, that must
billion.
Be, to 74.5 billion, which is good. And profit figure, what are we talking?
It's doubled.
The pre-tax profit figures totals have doubled, is it? Oh, yes, it has.
Yeah.
Aggregate pre-tax profit for the top 100 from 1 billion to 2 billion, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So it looks great. The trouble is,
it does, doesn't it?
those are the virtually all before Liz Truss was given a go.
Well, that's right. Yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
So because it's all retrospective, I think next year's top 100. When we talk this time next year, David, it's going to be a very different picture.
Yes, I think so. Yes, definitely. Yeah, I mean, as that chap at EY Parthenon was saying, that, you know, the tier one contractors seem to be, you know, sort of coping quite well at the moment. But as you've pointed out, there's a delay here. And so we're really talking about what happened last year, not what happened this year. I mean, profit margins for the top 100, the average profit margin last year was 1.6%. And this year it's 2.72%.
Wow, so, you know, 2.72 is the average profit margin. Yeah. I missed that. That's fantastic, theoretically.
Theoretically, yeah. So,
although in some ways pre-tax profit margin is a cruder metric than operating profit margin, I think, sometimes.
Interesting. It's always interesting that you can sort of dice and slice the figures and come up with all sorts of different trends and stuff like that. I mean, we look in also at the top 20 specialist contractors. We look at the top five companies by profitability. Actually, not by profitability, by pre-tax profit, which is obviously a slightly different thing. Balfour Beatty obviously has the biggest pre-tax profit because it's got the biggest turnover and it's got a reasonable profit margin. Whereas, you know, the least profitable companies, you know, people like Ferrovial, United Living Holdings, Erith, you know, they're not doing so well. So, you know, yeah, some people are doing very well and making a nice profit. Other people aren't.
Who are the big climbers? That's always, keep it positive. It's always nice to see people doing well.
The biggest climbers. I don't know.
I can tell you one of them because it leapt out at me. Is Glencar. Have gone up from
yes.
number 96 to number 49. But then they're based on revenues, is because their revenue yes. leapt from 160 million to 417 million in the space of a year, which is a huge leap. So it'd be interesting to see how their trajectory continues.
Yes.
The other possible headline we should mention is that Morgan Sindall have leapfrogged over Keir to go from third to second. They've swapped places. It used to be, for many years, Balfour Beatty, Keir, Morgan Sindall, and now Morgan Sindall jumped over Keir. Balfour Beatty, probably, I don't know, would they be in first place if we only included their UK numbers? If we stripped out Gammon and stripped out USA, North America?
Well, yeah, but that's a good point. Probably not. I mean, this is, again, one of the other caveats that we talk about companies which are, you know, UK-based construction firms, and yet we include people like Skanska and BAM in that, and Ferrovial. And, you know, they have UK-based operations, but they're not UK-owned.
Well, but they're UK-registered, and they get a company's house, and you can see that. So I think Ferrovial UK, you have to say, is it may be Spanish-owned, but it's a UK company.
Yeah, okay.
As Balfour Beatty PLC is a UK company, but we have this conversation every year. Well, and Keller is another one, which, I mean, the UK is a tiny bit of it. To call Keller Britain's fourth biggest construction company, as we do, is right in one sense, but misleading in another.
Yes, yes. It's not a construction company in the same way that Balfour Beatty is or Costain.
But it does different construction. What it does is
but it's a specialist contractor as well, which is interesting. It's not a main contractor.
Well, it's all round an interesting business model. I mean, there are a lot of quite large companies who just say, okay, this is our niche and this is what we're going to talk, you know, what we're going to mine in. Someone like VP, Vibroplant, as was, we've talked about before, who moved out of general plant now, but they've got various sort of niche platform, various niche plant and equipment related businesses. Yeah. So it's almost like sort of a mini conglomerate. And it doesn't try to be all things. It just says, okay, this is where the profits to be made. We'll follow that. And Keller, I mean, many of the, I don't know, a groundworks contractor or a steel frame contractor who gets to a certain size doing that and then says, oh, we'll do a bit more. They move from a tier two to a tier one contractor and take on main contracting. Keller have never looked to do that. They've just saying, this is what we do. They do everything in foundations, in ground engineering and whatever, but that's where they stop.
Yes, they're an interesting company. One of the sections in the top 100, which I always like reading, is the rich list, where we look at the people, the people and their families who make most money out of construction. And here we depart from our usual aim of just looking at contractors, because the richest person in our list, every year, actually, the richest person in our list is Anthony Bamford, Lord Bamford of JCB fame, who isn't in the construction industry at all. He's a manufacturer. But obviously, he wouldn't be in business at all if it wasn't for the construction industry. He's still
yeah, he would. He still make tractors.
Not quite as rich as he was, but, you know, not far off. But the one which cropped up for the first time this year, and I don't know if you picked this up, somebody I'd never heard of before, but he's shot right up there into the rich list. There's a chap called Bob Bull. Did you notice this? Have you heard of Bob Bull before?
I haven't. So I did read the, we talked about earlier, proofreading the magazine. It was new to me.
Bob Bull, he builds bungalows. He's now number three, Bob Bull and his family. He's worth nearly £2 billion.
Having been bankrupt 9 years ago.
Yeah,
7 years ago, beg your pardon.
His business, and I think it was a business launched by his dad, was in holiday homes or sort of mobile homes.
Caravan parks you've got here, yeah.
Caravan parks, that's what I was thinking. Yeah, and they had a really big caravan park business somewhere down on the south coast. I think he's Southampton based. Yeah, and I think he inherited that business from his dad, and it went under, and he was declared bankrupt not long ago, 2016. But then he decided to move into, he's got this business model, which is quite interesting. He basically persuades old people to sell their houses, their big empty houses, because they've been empty nesters for the previous couple of decades, and move into these, well, basically downsize and move into his developments. And it's a really, really successful, profitable enterprise. So, yeah, Bob Bull, I mean, when I Googled him, his company, by the way, is called Royal Life. That's just one word, Royal, with an E between the L's. Royal Life. He's now got 90 gated communities of fully furnished bungalows for people aged 45 and over. I said old people. 45 is nearly 20 years younger than me. All over the South Coast, sort of Cornwall, Dorset, Hampshire, Kent and...
Well, they're chalets, aren't they? They're sort of posh...
They are basically, yeah.
As I said, the posh caravans. It's more than that, but it's a chalet park.
Yeah. So basically, people sort of release their equity. You know, they're living in, say, a sort of a four bedroom detached house somewhere. They're sitting on a pile of money. Effectively, they don't need. They only need one of the bedrooms, and they probably only use one or two of the reception rooms. So they downsize, move into one of his developments, and they've got all the facilities they need. And, you know, they've got loads of dosh to spend on cruises and stuff like this. So, you know, it's a great business model, and he's done extremely nicely out of it. Yeah, so he's a name to watch, certainly. He's shot up into the... into the rich list, number three. And number three after, of course, our friend Lord Bamford and John Bloor in second place. Bamford's fortune is worth $5.9 billion, by the way.
Allegedly.
Allegedly. John Bloor is worth just under $3.5 billion. And, of course, he's in house building and also motorcycles. I don't know which is the profitable side of that, but I don't suppose it's the motorcycles.
But it's all, I mean, it's fun to look at these rich lists. We look at, you know, this is all taken from the Sunday Times. But yeah. when you say something like £415 million worth of Sir James Waite and family, you mm-hmm. kind of think, oh, you know, Mr. or Sir James and Lady, whatever their name is, Waite and their, however many kids they've got, I've got £415 million. Not exactly. That's the entire Waits family, and there are quite a lot of them, I think, aren't there?
I don't know much about the Waits family.
I think there are several brothers and generations and whatever.
Right.
So and again, you know, when things say "and family," they can be spread.
Yeah.
Quite far.
So you're saying that Sir James Waits personally might only be worth, say, I don't know, 50 million?
He's probably struggling down to his last 50 million, maybe, yeah.
Yeah. Poor man. Poor chap, yeah, yeah. Well, anyway.
But also, the other thing is that when you're talking about these people with vast wealth, that's based on a valuation of their assets, which is, you know, yeah. a company which, in some cases, might not have the same value if they weren't there. I mean, I don't know about any people on these lists would be the same, but one could imagine that part of the value of Dyson, for example, is because Sir James Dyson is there. And if he sold the company to me, the value of the company would collapse overnight.
Oh, I think you're doing yourself an injustice there, Phil.
But you take my point. The valuations are inherently... finger in the air. Well, they're financial metrics, of course.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
It's not cash in the bank.
Phil, talking about, I think we ought to move on because I mean, we've been talking about rich people.
Yeah, we're getting on too long, haven't we?
And of course, I'm trying to segue here by saying that, you know...
Talking about rich families. And McAlpine's
rich families.
Rich families. But the McAlpine family aren't on this list, which is surprising. You would have thought there would be a McAlpine on the rich list.
Yeah,
always
I
used to
have
be.
Thought so. Yeah, the Murphys are there.
I think the McAlpines have cleverly squirreled it away. Either that someone from McAlpine is very friendly with someone important at the Sunday Times and have kept them out of it.
Shall we move on to our next topic? We talked enough about rich people. Of course, the fortunes made in construction are nothing compared to the fortunes that can be made in Hollywood. Is that a good enough segue? I think it'll do. And it's Hollywood that we want to talk about now, isn't it, Phil? Go on, tell us. And you were talking about the McAlpines, so well, we've...
okay, this is our and finally item, folks. Yeah. You may have seen it directly on either LinkedIn or the platform formerly known as Twitter, now called, is it called, do you pronounce it Kiss or X?
Oh, God knows.
I think X. It's X. I think it's X.
Yeah.
But it ought to be called Kiss, I think. But anyway, it's X. Some people in, I think it's one person in particular, in some of Robert McAlpine's social media and marketing communications department has had some fun, last mm-hmm. week. And jumping on the bandwagon of one of this summer's big blockbuster Hollywood movies,
yeah,
they've taken some Barbie dolls out onto a construction site, dressed in as construction Barbie, with high-vis jacket and hard hats and so on, and filmed Barbie at work around a around construction site. And this has had a storming reaction on, I don't know what's doing on what used to be known as Twitter. I don't look at it, but
certainly on LinkedIn, I think.
But on LinkedIn, more than 1,000 reactions in just a week, 160 comments, 112 reposts. Now, I know that's probably not big numbers for, you know, if a new iPhone comes out or something, but for sure. a construction company having a bit of fun, these are big numbers. And I thought it was worth reporting on the basis of that. More particularly, what's interesting are the comments it's generated. Now, to me, there's a lot one could get one's teeth into. First of all, there's jumping on the bandwagon. Well, I don't mind. That's fun. I mean, this Barbie film's been all over the papers.
Yeah, everybody's talking about it.
And I haven't seen the film. I'm not even going to ask you if you've seen it. I can't imagine for a minute you'd have gone to see it. But by all accounts, from what I read, it's not the Barbie film you might expect it to be. It's not My Little Pony, the film. It's actually quite a sophisticated, intelligent people. I can't remember the name of the woman director, but I've seen a couple of her films.
Yeah.
And, you know, by all accounts, it's a smart film.
Yeah.
And the idea of jumping on the bandwagon, yeah, great, go for it. Then, had they done this, had McAlpine posted this short video, you know, 1 minute video, 2 minute video, whatever it is, of Barbie on a construction site, a year ago, outside of the context of the Barbie film, because the Barbie film, by and large, as I understand it, I won't say it demolishes, but it certainly walks all over and the stereotype of Barbie as being a airheaded, you know, bimbo that would fall over if she was actually a real person kind of thing because of her body shape. It's not that old fashioned. I mean, it used to be, I think, that Barbie would be a term of abuse, perhaps.
Absolutely.
Whereas there's been a certain reclaiming of her as a, you know, a strong feminist icon role model, I think. God, what do I know about these things?
I think that's what the film tried to do. I haven't seen it, but I gather that's the message.
But anyway, what I'm trying to say is that had McAlpine put up this particular film a year or 5 years ago, I think it would have drawn different sorts of comments. It would have drawn more negative reaction, more reaction. I mean, a lot of the men reacting are saying things like, isn't this a bit sexist? You know, aren't women more than just Barbie dolls and this, that and the other? And it's like, you know, why's Barbie got a pink hard hat? Is that because she's a girl? Mm-hmm. Isn't that sexist? And these sort of things. Whereas almost without exception, the women who have commented on what I've seen on LinkedIn are going, this is fantastic. This is great. This is superb. This is what we need. You know, female role models in construction. Great, great, great. And whether it's because women have got more of a sense of humour or women don't have the same, you know, men of our age, background, demographic, etc., David, I think we find it a bit of a minefield to know quite what to say and when to say in a lot of discussions. Clearly, my opinion on this topic is not valid. I'll just shut up at risk of saying something wrong. But if we were going to say things, we'd hopefully, you know, seek to call out feminism, to call out
sexism, not feminism.
So it's like it comes from a good place. But actually, women can say, "Yeah, you're being too sensitive here, blokes. This is just fun, and it's great fun, and it's positive, and rah rah." Anyway, I wanted to talk about all this with the is it a guy called Alex Roberts at Robert McAlpine, one of the social media communications people, apparently is the creative genius behind this. And I tried to get him on to come and join us to talk about this. but unfortunately he's not around.
Prior engagement. No, that's a shame. That is a shame. I don't know whether or not it's because, you know, it's had a mixed reception. Some people are highly critical of it, and maybe having posted it, McAlpine would rather just leave it there and not comment any further.
I don't think it was a mixed reception. I mean, because of the hugely positive, I think it was much more positive than negative. Because the negative comments seemed almost all to come, in fact, probably all to come from men, it almost, is it sexy to say that men's opinions don't count when it comes to this conversation? But they were devalidated because the comments came from men. And the fact that the women were happy, and I'm not just talking about, in inverted commas, proper women who work in the industry, who are, you know, who've got what's your expression? A horse in the race or a dog in the fight. Yes. The people who are taking a front line in trying to promote the role of women in the industry see this as a positive thing. Then the fact that some bloke goes, "Oh, why has Barbie got a pink hat?" Becomes, I still think that's an interesting point. I mean, it's at what point does promotion of a stereotype with humour
tip over
and backfire? I don't think this did backfire.
No,
but it might have done.
It might have done. But I while you've been talking, I was looking at the LinkedIn post actually, and one of the two other comments, there was somebody, a woman called Rachel, who said, "I read about this post on the Construction Index daily update this morning, so I've headed here to have a look at what's been going on." So, and then she talks about it. She went to see the Barbie film and she said, "My review, Barbie has lifted my soul." You know, so I mean, that's a woman speaking there, and McAlpine has responded by saying, "Thank you so much for your kind comments. Together we can break stereotypes and prove that the construction industry is for everyone." So, you know, it's very easy to sort of criticise it, you know, because you're sort of promoting the Barbie stereotype. But in actual fact, that doesn't seem to be the way most people are interpreting it. I mean, they could have gone the other way. I mean, there's another big blockbuster out there breaking box office records at the moment. They could have gone around putting little replica hydrogen bombs on site and, you know, and sort of tapped into the Oppenheimer sort of zeitgeist. But luckily they chose Barbie instead.
Less humour there.
So, interesting. I thought we started off this conversation talking about marketing and publicity and stuff like that, and I think this is probably one example of where somebody's, as you say, having a bit of fun, and it seems to have worked, generally speaking.
I still think, though, if there are any women on construction site with hair like Barbie, I think it's probably a good idea to tie it up.
Yeah, I think so. Talking about tying things up, Phil, we've been talking for an awfully long time. Do you think we should tie it up?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay.
Oh yeah, one final item before we go, if I may. We talk a lot about Stonehenge, or we have talked a lot about the Stonehenge, particularly the Stonehenge Tunnel, on this podcast over the years. Had an email from Jeanette Harper this morning saying she's clearly got she says the tunnel's a disgusting waste of money, it would be very harmful. She's got a suggestion instead of a tunnel, but doesn't know how to go about promoting it and thinks it might be too late. She says they should build an Eden Project-style bubble, a big dome over the stones. It could even have an open roof. It would protect the stones from pollution and elements. It would be an attraction in its own right. And then the traffic that slows down to look at the stones wouldn't have the stones to see. You couldn't see the stones, so the traffic wouldn't slow down. And so I said, there's a slight flaw with that, because if they put up the Eden Project over the stones, it would look even more spectacular. And even more traffic would slow down even more to gawp at it.
Yes.
So it occurred to me that she might be onto something. They could just plant a whole load of Lelandii.
Well, that would work.
As we know,
planting
trees saves the planet.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good
idea. It would screen off the stones. The Lelandii would eat all the fumes from the cars. And everyone would just whiz by.
Yeah, why not?
Anyway, I might sell that one to Keir Starmer. I gather he's looking for some policies.
Yeah, he'll probably snap that one up. Okay, Phil.
Yeah, over and out, David. Good to talk to you. See you next 2 weeks' time.
Yes,
in the
indeed.
Middle of September by then. Listeners, thank you very much. But from David and I, goodbye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.